Understanding the Background of Biblical Texts was presented by Ron Julian on November 11, 2003 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the seventh talk in part one of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
For tonight and the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be handing out some advice about reading the Bible for understanding. Before I start into my advice, I just have a few preliminary comments I wanted to make. This may overlap a little bit with some things that David said, but I just want you to know where I'm coming from and what my expectations are as we start into this. Our year-long series here is called Doing Christianity. And the sorts of things that we're talking about in this series are not intended to just be for pastors or seminary students or professional Bible students or something like that. We are exploring various aspects of what it means to be a Christian and to live as a Christian. You and I have been called to be disciples of Jesus Christ, and what we're trying to do is to explore what that means. What does it mean to be a student of Jesus? What does a student of Jesus do? So, my comments for the next 3 weeks are intended to be about things that I think are helpful and relevant to all Christians to understand, not just for people who are planning to be full-time Bible students or something like that. My conviction is that every one of us, every single human being, faces a fundamental issue. That basically, our lives are all about the issue of whether we will accept the truth of things or not. My life is an opportunity to come to know myself, to know other people, to know the world around me and what is valuable in that world, and to know God as He has revealed Himself in creation and in His Word, in the Bible. So the question is, as I live my life, will I take the opportunity to know myself as I am, or will I refuse that knowledge and insist that I'm something else? Will I know my neighbor as he or she is? Will I admit the true value of things in the world? Will I admit that God is who He is? Will I submit to the truth of Himself that He has revealed? Or will I push it aside and say, no, I want things to be some other way? Now, no one has perfect knowledge. We are all mistaken in many ways about all of those things, about ourselves and about others and about the world and about God. It's not that my expectation is that any of us are going to arrive in this lifetime at a perfect understanding of any of those things. But the issue is, for me as a human being, am I willing to follow the evidence where it leads? As the opportunity to know myself comes to me, as the opportunity to know God comes to me, am I going to take it, or am I going to take another road? Am I willing to be corrected? Am I willing to move from a poor understanding to a better one? That's really the issue. All of us are at various stages in our understanding of things, and none of us is all that far along. But the question is, which direction am I facing? Am I headed towards the truth, or am I headed away from it? Well, this is the truth as well about what we encounter when we come to the Bible. God has revealed Himself in the Bible. We are arguing in this series, at least in this part of this series, that the Bible is written in normal human language and that therefore it is in principle understandable. It can be understood. Is it hard to understand sometimes? Yes. Will we understand it perfectly? No. Will we make mistakes in our understanding of it? Yes. But we can, over time, move toward a better understanding of what the Bible is saying if we are willing to do so. The most important thing is that I be a person willing to know the truth. I would argue that you and I have a moral obligation to try to understand what anyone says when they're communicating. When someone is talking to me, when someone has written something, I have a moral obligation to try to get at what it is that person was trying to say. How much more so, then, do I have a moral obligation to try to come to terms with what the biblical authors are trying to say? And I think we all know the kind of thing I'm talking about. We've all seen how stubbornness and selfishness and sin can enter in and make people unwilling to see what people mean in their words. When I hear a politician quoting what his opponent has said, it's so common for me to have that sense that that politician is not willing to know what it is that his opponent really meant when he said that. He is determined to twist it, to take it and make it as bad as he can make it for his own advantage. Well, from my perspective, that's a moral issue. He could have done better. He could have known more than he chose to what it was his opponent was trying to say. Well, I think that's the truth. That's what I face when I come to the Bible. It is true what people say, that you can use the Bible to prove anything. And it's true. You can. That is, if you are unwilling to let the Bible speak for itself, if you are unwilling to learn its language and let it set its own agenda. But if I am open to its message and patient, over time I will learn that there is a coherence to that message. And I will find that you cannot make the Bible say anything you want it to if you are humble and paying attention. Okay, so the sorts of things that I'm talking about here for the next several weeks are intended to be advice, intended to give some perspective to all truth-seeking Christians. Jesus meant to say something in particular. Paul meant to say something in particular. And is there anything that I need to know that would be helpful to me to make sure that I am paying the best attention that I can to what they said? What do I need to know so that I can evaluate what my teachers are saying to me when they tell me this is what the Bible says, to make sure that they're paying the best attention that they can to what's being said? So that's what I'm trying to accomplish. I'm just trying to give us some perspective on how do I tell when my understanding of a text, and in particular the Bible, is lining up with what was actually meant there. What sort of thing would I be looking for? What sort of evidence would I have? And a lot of what I have to say is basically common sense, stepping back and thinking about how is it that we know what each other means when we speak, and applying that to the Bible. My topic tonight is the role of background material in our understanding of the Bible, and let me explain what I mean by that. If you stop and think about it, you may have thought about this before, you may have not, but language, human communication, when I talk to you, when you talk to me, when I read a book, when I read the Bible, all human communication depends on the two parties, the reader and the author or the speaker. Those two parties have to know some things already in common. Communication isn't possible between two entities, between two beings that have nothing in common. They have to know something together before they can communicate. Now, one of those things, obviously, that you have to know already is language. If you're speaking in French and I only speak English, you're certainly attempting to communicate, but I'm probably not going to get it. How could I? I don't know the language. You are expecting me to already know that, and yet I don't. So you're stuck. We'll talk about that part of things a little bit more next time. But what I want to concentrate on tonight are those other sorts of things that I need to know in order to understand what somebody else is saying. I could show up here with you and probably I could start talking about Bill Clinton and interns, or weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or the modesty of Britney Spears. It's a small topic. And I would bet most of you already know things about that. If I say those things, something comes to mind. I could make a joke about Britney Spears or about Bill Clinton or about Saddam Hussein, and I wouldn't have to explain to you the premises behind it. It might not be a good joke, it might not be funny, but you would already know what you needed to know to follow where I was going. But there are people in the world, or especially people who have lived at other times, that if I was to try that same joke on them, they wouldn't have the foggiest idea what I'm talking about, because they don't have the experience that I do. They didn't know about Bill Clinton and interns or Saddam Hussein or whatever. So, you know, it means nothing to them. They're in the dark. That's the sort of thing that I mean by background material. It's all of that stuff that I learn by living in my culture, being a human being. There are things that I know because I'm an American. There are things that I know because I live in Eugene. There are things that I know because I live in my particular family, in my particular house. There are things that I can say to my wife where I assume that she knows what I'm talking about, that I would have to explain it to you because you don't have our common experience. But there are lots of things about living in Eugene that I could talk to you about, and I wouldn't bother to explain myself because I know you know about it just as well as I do. That's what we're talking about with background material. Those things that the author in his head is thinking, you already know this. You already know what I'm talking about, so I don't have to explain it to you. I can work with it and move on. Let's take, for example, the very first verse in the New Testament. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Okay, well, if I just launch in and say I'm going to start reading the New Testament and I read that sentence, I can see that it is a genealogy, it says there, of someone named Jesus. But Matthew calls him the Christ. What is that? Is that his last name? Does that mean something in particular? Is that significant that he is Jesus Christ? He's called the son of Abraham. Is that significant? Is being the son of Abraham a big deal? I mean, was Abraham real rich and so this Jesus guy is real rich? Or what's going on? He's also called the son of David. What's the significance of that? In fact, in the very first verse in the New Testament, Matthew is assuming a great deal of prior knowledge on his reader's part. He knows, he is assuming that they are familiar with the concepts from the Old Testament scriptures. In fact, that they've lived with those concepts in the Jewish culture that he is familiar with. So, he doesn't stop to explain why being a son of Abraham would be significant. He assumes that they know why being a son of Abraham would be significant. And in fact, once we see the significance of those ideas, we can see that Matthew has said a mouthful. In that first sentence, he has said some very theologically significant things. But the significance of them will go right past me if I don't have some prior background on things like what does it mean to be the Christ, and who was Abraham, and why would being his son be significant, and who's David, and why would being his son be significant. And yet all of that is there. Matthew intends to communicate that this Jesus, he is the one who is the Christ, who is the son of Abraham, who is the son of David. And he's assuming that his readers will know enough to be able to figure out why that's significant. So, if we run into that in the first verse in the New Testament, I would imagine that we'll probably run into that problem again as we go through it. And the fact is that we do on pretty much every page. So, there are three important things to remember about background information, things I want to call to your attention, and then I want to give you a few pieces of advice. But three important things. First of all, a speaker or author only tends to explain the things he thinks his audience does not know. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the book that E.D. Hirsch wrote called Cultural Literacy. This was a number of years ago now. But one of the things that he does is refer to a number of studies that were done. And in one of these studies, they had people going up and asking people for directions to a certain spot. Some of the people did it in such a way that they communicated, implied or explicitly, that they were from the area, that they were familiar with the area, and others gave more the impression that they were tourists and weren't familiar with things. And the study showed how, time and time again, people gauged how much information they gave the person to how much they thought they already knew. If they gave off the vibe that they were from the area, then they gave them very short instructions. If they gave off the vibe that they were tourists, then they gave them very explicit and complicated instructions. Because we tend to, I mean, we might be conservative and explain a little more than we think a person needs, but for the most part, we start with our picture of what do you know, and we start talking from there. Now, that's relevant to us in reading the Bible, because I know this is not good news, and many of us would like to treat the Bible as if this is not the case, but the fact is, when I am reading the biblical authors, they were not writing to me. When Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, there's a reason we call it 1 Corinthians, because it was his first letter to the Corinthians. It was to the Corinthians. And when he's deciding, what am I going to explain and what am I not going to explain, he's deciding it on the basis of what do the Corinthians already know. Not what does Ron know in the 21st century, but what do the Corinthians in the first century know. I don't explain to them what I know that they already know. I only explain to them what I think they need to know. Well, the problem is, I could use some more explanation than what they did, because they know a lot about the situation into which he's writing that I don't know. So I'm at something of a disadvantage. But the fact is, it's just true. Paul gauged how much he explained based on what he thought they needed to hear. The most frustrating example of that sort of thing is in the Thessalonian letters, where Paul at one point says, "You remember when I was with you, I explained these things to you." Okay. No, I wasn't there. Could you, you know, was it like paper expensive or something? Couldn't you have just, you know, gone on a little farther? But no. He says, you know what I'm talking about. I told you already. Okay. The second important thing to remember. First is, speaker only tends to explain things that he thinks they need to know. Secondly, if I as the audience don't know the background, I may find a speaker or a particular writing harder to understand. Just in terms of comprehension, I may, in confronting it at first, not know what to do with it. Again, in the book Cultural Literacy, Hirsch cites another study where they took Americans, I think it was Americans, and people from India, Indians but not American Indians, you know, people from India. And they gave both groups two stories. One was a story about an American wedding, and one of them was a story about an Indian wedding. And American weddings and Indian weddings are very different culturally in how they're handled. And then they asked people questions to test their comprehension of what they had read. And not surprisingly, the Americans tested very highly in comprehending the story about the American wedding and very poorly in comprehending the story about the Indian wedding and vice versa. I mean, it's just, when I'm familiar with what's going on, I can take it right in and immediately see what's happening. But if it's coming from a place that is unfamiliar to me, then I don't know how to put all the pieces together. Well, this is very relevant to us in studying the Bible, because we come across things like that all the time in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, places where we recognize, we bump into it and say, you know, I don't quite get what's happening here. I'm not sure what this is about. Some of them we may never know until things are all over. When Paul talks about baptizing for the dead, we don't know what he was talking about. I mean, we just bump into that and say, you know, I don't really know what his argument is here, because my problem is I have no idea what that is. And nobody knows what it is. We have no evidence at all for what that practice of baptizing for the dead was. We don't know if Paul approves of it or disapproves of it. We don't even know what it was. You read the famous section in 1 Corinthians 11, which I have the privilege of having to teach next Sunday at our church in 1 Corinthians about the hair coverings and all that stuff. You immediately bump into the problem. What is he talking about? What was the practice with hair coverings? I mean, is it they had something on, it meant something? If they didn't have something on, it meant something? Is it even talking about coverings, or something about veils, or is it talking about wearing your hair down? I mean, we immediately come up against this, and our first response is, we don't quite know what to make of it. What's going on? Again, because it's in a cultural setting that we don't know necessarily right off what it is their practice was, or what the issue was there, and so on. So there are a lot of places where my initial response is going to be, I don't quite get it because I don't know what we're talking about. Not the way the people that the letter was written to know. They would have known immediately what the issue was. They didn't have my problem, but I have my problem, and we all here have that problem because we're not living in that culture. And then the third point I wanted to make is that even worse than the last one, where if I don't know the background, I find myself at a loss and not quite knowing how to understand it. What can be even worse is I think I know the background, but I'm wrong. I have the wrong picture in my head of what was going on. And then what happens is I can take and misconstrue what I'm reading, turn it into something that it was not intended to be, because I have a different picture of what it was about than what it in fact was about. So, you know, if I show you a note from a friend and it ends with the line, I'm out of here. Now, in fact, this is a note that my friend sent me before he went on vacation. But if I tell you this is a note that I got from my friend that is a suicide note, now the significance of I'm out of here has taken on an entirely different slant. And I might go looking at it, and every line in that note, I'm going to see in a certain, you know, tragic sense. Everything there I'm going to take and read in a certain way that is in fact an imposition on it. It was never intended to be that. It's just a note, you know, I'm going on vacation. That's all it was about. But if I think that it's about something else, that's how I'm going to tend to read it. And so I could actually draw conclusions from the same text that are quite different than what the text was actually about. And pretty basic commonsensical things that I'm trying to say here, but it's important for us as readers of the Bible that we not think that somehow the Bible is immune to this sort of thing. I would take care about this sort of thing if I was reading the newspaper or talking to you. I recognize, yes, I might be misunderstanding. I might have to find out something about what are we talking about. Well, that's true when it comes to the Bible. This is extremely relevant to us. The thing that we most have to guard ourselves against when we read the Bible is that we just be careful that we are not imposing our own background assumptions on the text, assuming that it's coming from some place where it isn't. I mean, all I can do is be careful, but that care is something that's very important. Just recently, I was listening to a talk on 1 Corinthians by a man who has written a commentary on 1 Corinthians, and I know he was probably just speaking fast, and if you had the chance to talk to him about it, he would probably backpedal. But I was startled that his only comment when he was going through the early part of 1 Corinthians, where Paul talks about how the message of Christ crucified is a stumbling block to the Jews. And his comment was, he says, you know, if you mention the cross to most Jews, they immediately think of the Holocaust. Well, That's probably true. If you've dealt with talking to Jewish people about Christianity, the Holocaust is a huge problem to overcome. But you see the problem here. It's very unlikely that Paul, when he said the cross is a stumbling block to the Jews, had the Holocaust in mind, because the Holocaust hadn't happened yet when Paul was talking. So, now, I don't want to be unfair. I'm sure that the commentator knows that the Holocaust happened after Paul was talking. But you can see what happened. He was so anxious to be relevant, so anxious to apply this verse to our situation, that he immediately jumped to the present without stopping and asking the question, what did this mean to Paul when he said it? What was he getting at? Why is the cross a stumbling block to the Jews in his time? What sort of thing did he have in mind? Because it was certainly not the Holocaust that was the problem. I mean, he was talking about something else. And so, in this particular case, the commentator has passed over that verse and hasn't really told me anything helpful yet. He hasn't told me anything that gets me in touch with what sort of thing did Paul have in mind when he said that. Because for Paul, in a different cultural situation, the issue was very different. Okay, so I hope I'm being clear about what I think the basic problem is. I want to give just a couple of pieces of what I think of as fairly practical, down-to-earth advice. What do I think this means to us? For every Christian, as we think about, as I read the Bible, as I listen to what other people say about what the Bible means, as I listen to sermons about what the Bible means, and so on, what are some things that I ought to think about? My number one piece of advice, this is my number one piece of advice for all of the issues involving Bible study. This is my number one piece of advice, period. Number one, care enough about understanding Jesus, Paul, Peter, Isaiah, whoever. Care enough about understanding what they're saying to slow down, be patient, and try to find out what they have on their mind. It is so easy for me to come to the Bible with my own set of assumptions and questions, grab a verse, pull it out, and run. And I'm just urging us all to not do that. We need to slow down and say, I know that I would love for this verse to be telling me what to do in this situation, but before I grab it and run, I had better stop and make sure that that's actually what was being talked about here. That's an important step of maturity for any believer, is to say, I want to know what Jesus was talking about. I want to know what Paul was talking about. Even if I find out in the end that this verse doesn't tell me what I wanted to know, nonetheless, I want to know what it is about. And I think that's the attitude that we need to bring to the issue of background information. Why should I bother to try to understand the background of the Bible anyway? That is all just dead history. And that, I'm not setting up a straw man when I talk that way. I have encountered it in my life. Christians who think somehow that trying to learn about the historical background to the Bible is somehow not spiritual. I mean, why would I care about that? Those are dead people. They're all dead. Dead. They're dead. But I'm living. I have my life that I have to live. So forget about, what do I care about who Apollos was, or what the problem was in Corinth, or what the Colossian heresy was, or who are these Hebrews that the letter of the Hebrews is written to? That's their problem. My problem is I need to know what to do about X, and I need to know about what to do about Y, and so I'm going to find a verse that'll tell me about that, and that's what I want. Well, no. The ancient world is the world into which God chose to enter and reveal himself. It is the ancient world to which the prophets were speaking, to which the apostles were speaking, to which Jesus was speaking. As Peter said to Jesus, you have the words of eternal life. And if that's true, then I ought to care about that enough to try to figure out what he meant by those words. And if I refuse to learn anything about the world into which Jesus spoke, then I'm risking misunderstanding what he was saying. I probably will misunderstand at least some of what he was saying if I don't try to put myself into the situation into which he's speaking so that I can see what it is he's talking about. So, that's my first piece of advice, is we need to start by recognizing that it's important. I want to be humble before the text and let the text tell me what it's about. Okay, my second piece of advice, the Bible itself is a great source of background information. Without becoming a scholar or rummaging around in dusty libraries with old scrolls in them or anything like that, I can learn a lot about the world into which the Bible was written, about the situations that the letters in the New Testament are written into, just by familiarizing myself with what is in the Bible. We like around here to use the example of 1 Corinthians because there are some good examples of this in 1 Corinthians. For example, in the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about this problem that has developed in Corinth, factions that have arisen among them. Some say, we like Apollos the best, we're his guy. Some say, no, we like Paul the best, and others, other people, and so on. So, for four chapters, Paul talks about that off and on. He keeps coming back to this problem that people have chosen up sides, especially between himself and Apollos. Also, in those same chapters, he talks a lot about the way he teaches and speaks. He defends the way he talks and the way he preaches the gospel. He defends it as true wisdom. Well, what is the situation into which Paul is writing? Why is he saying those things? Well, there's some helpful information in the Bible itself that can help me to get perspective on that. For example, the book of Acts, Luke writing the story of Paul's missionary journeys, tells the story of how Paul founded the church in Corinth. It tells the story of Paul leaving the church, and it tells the story of Apollos coming and being a part of the church. So in Acts, I can get a fair amount of information about Paul's relationship with the Corinthians and who Apollos was and Apollos' relationship with the Corinthians that helps me get some perspective on what Paul's saying in this letter. Likewise, in 2 Corinthians, the letter that Paul wrote after 1 Corinthians, I see more information about Paul's relationship with the Corinthians. And there are some very interesting statements that he makes that shows what the Corinthians, at least some of them, thought about Paul and the way he speaks. So, in a section of a letter that talks a lot about Apollos and Paul and the way Paul speaks, it can be very relevant to notice that in Acts and in 2 Corinthians, I have more information about those topics that may or may not be helpful to me in sorting out what he's saying. I'll give you a hint. It is helpful to sorting out what he's saying. But that's just right there in the Bible itself. It's not that hard to find. All I have to do is be aware. I'm reading a letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Acts is about Paul's relationship with various churches. Maybe I should look there to see if it says something about the Corinthians. And 2 Corinthians is written to the same folks, so maybe I should read that and see if I can find some information. It's not a particularly difficult thing to do. It's not that hard to think of, really, if once you get the idea. What I would like to do is see if I can find some more information about what was going on here. Okay. Practically speaking, then, how can I gain background information from the Bible? I just gave an example. I just think it over and think, well, that might be a good place to look. But besides that, one way to gain background information from the Bible, I know this sounds strange, but I'm very serious as a piece of advice here. I can gain background information from the Bible by reading it. The more you read the Bible, the more exposure you will get to its world, and the more you will experience you will be in that world. Now, some of us have been warned in our experience not to read the Bible for just head knowledge, but to, I need to take it and immediately apply it to my life. Well, yes, absolutely, the goal of reading the Bible ultimately is to apply it to my life. If I leave it so that it has no relevance to the way I live my life, then I have read the Bible wrongly. But it's wrong to contrast that sort of reading with head knowledge, as if somehow learning things from the Bible was a bad thing to do. One of the benefits of reading the Bible now is that I can be gaining knowledge of the world of the Bible so that later on, the more I read, the more able I am to understand and apply what I'm looking at. So it may very well be that in my first readings in the Bible, I may not come away with a great understanding of the theology or argument of everything that I see there, but I'm going to get exposure to things like, who are the Pharisees, and who are the Sadducees, and who are the Samaritans, and who is the high priest, all a part of the world of the New Testament. I'll see concepts over and over again, like the Christ, or the kingdom of God, or justification, and things like that, all of which are building up my picture of the world in which these letters and prophecies are being spoken. So, honestly, there is a great value to us as if we want to become familiar enough with the world of the Bible to be able to work with it a little bit. There's a great value in just regularly reading it so that I start to get familiar with what's there. Secondly, perhaps many of you are familiar with a very handy, I was going to call it a little book, but it's not a little book. It's a big book. It's called a concordance. And basically, you take your concordance. If you're using a New American Standard Bible, for instance, you would want a New American Standard concordance. And you look at the particular word in the Bible that you're interested in, and it will show you every place in your translation where that word is used. So, if you're reading in 1 Corinthians and you come across Paul talking about Apollos, and you want to know who Apollos is, one of the things you can do is get out that concordance, look up the word Apollos, and it will show you every verse in the Bible where Apollos is mentioned. So, just a very handy, quick sort of way of going and exposing myself to other sources of information in the Bible itself. So, that's not the sort of tool that you have to be a scholar or a trained biblical exegete to be able to use. It's very simple. And you can learn things using a book like that without a lot of specialized training. And then finally, the third piece of practical advice I would give you about how we can gain background information from the Bible itself is when I'm reading a particular book, I want to look for the clues in the book itself as to what the background situation is. For example, you take a hard book like Hebrews. The book of Hebrews is hard. The letter to the Hebrews is a difficult book to get a hold of. The author doesn't start out by saying, okay, now before I start telling you what I want to tell you, let me review your situation and remind you what's going on. He just launches in. He starts talking. Why? What is he talking about? Why is he talking about these things? What do the things that he's talking about in Hebrews have to do with each other? What should I see them as being relevant to? Well, I can notice that there are certain themes that show up a lot in the book that may help me get some idea of what the situation is into which he's writing. For instance, Jesus is superior to the angels. God did not subject the world to come to angels, but to men. Jesus had to be a man like those he was saving. Jesus had to suffer as a man in order to bring men salvation. Jesus had to be one of us in order to be our high priest. Jesus understands us because he was tempted as we are. So you'll notice that in all of those things that I talked about here, there's this common thread about Jesus being a man. It sure seems as if something about the situation into which the author of Hebrews is writing would have something to do with that. He's going out of his way to defend the idea that Jesus had to be a man. It is good that he was a man. It is good that he suffered and died. It is good that he was like us so he could be our high priest. He is superior to angels, and so on. And so, just as a first approximation, we might suspect that the situation into which the book of Hebrews is being written has something to do with some sort of problem about the idea of Jesus being a man. We could understand how a group of Jews might be balking at the idea that this guy who was a mere man who died on a cross, a bloody and shameful death, would be the Messiah, the Christ of God. And indeed, ultimately, I would argue that is a significant part of the problem into which that letter is being written. But part of the way I can know that is that's what he's talking about. Why would he be defending something that they already thought was true? It's most likely that he's defending the very thing that they're having trouble with. And he keeps coming at it from all sorts of different angles. Okay, so the main point I wanted to make in here was, in various ways, the Bible itself, without any recourse to anything particularly fancy or fancy historical research or anything like that, the Bible itself can be a great source of information to me about the world in which the Bible was written. I can learn a lot that can be very helpful in understanding the Bible by familiarizing myself with the world of the Bible in the Bible itself. Okay, next, it is true that there are other things that would be nice to know about the world of the Bible, and it is nice for me to know that there are resources out there where I can learn about them. Bible encyclopedias, commentaries, and things like that, where I can come to learn something more about the ancient world. I don't have to be a scholar. I don't have to be highly trained to use these sources of information. There's a lot that I can pick up from books that are quite accessible and relatively easy to use. And now some of them, there are books out there that are not so accessible and easy to use, but there are many that are. Now, for example, in 1 Corinthians, that same section I was talking to you about, where Paul talks about Apollos and himself, and he defends the fact that he speaks in a certain way. One of the themes that he explores a lot in that section is the theme of wisdom. Well, it's possible, I think it is relevant actually, to come to know a little bit more about the Greek and Roman attitudes towards a concept like wisdom. Because Paul is basically defending his concept of wisdom against their concept of wisdom. And it might be helpful to know, for example, that there were groups like the Sophists at various times in Greek history and influential in Rome as well, who had a certain attitude, a certain take towards wisdom, and that they were highly respected by many people. They were not respected by other people, but many people thought the Sophists were really cool. And sophist, the word sophist, comes from the Greek word for wisdom. Basically, sophistry was all about wisdom. So, there's a place where coming to get a little historical background information that I wouldn't find in the Bible itself can be helpful, can give me a little perspective on what it is that Paul's talking about. Now, I want to give a word of caution when it comes to this sort of thing, is that when you're using reference books or when you're listening to somebody teaching, even someone like me, I just made this generalized comment about the sophists. I didn't say very much about them. But you may hear a pastor or a teacher make reference and say, well, we know from history that this was true about this group and so on. Not everything that everybody says about what happens back there is true. I mean, I wish I could say you don't have to worry about this, but the fact is you do have to worry about it. That historians have their own biases, and sometimes people say this is the way it was, when what they really mean is, I have two pieces of evidence and a big conclusion that I've jumped to based on those two pieces of evidence. What I'd really like to know is, how did you decide that was true? How do you know that in fact it's the case? All I've got is the fact they said, this is the way it was. All of us, you don't have to be a scholar to listen to that sort of stuff with a grain of salt. To just say, well, okay, I'm just going to keep listening to folks and maybe that is true, and maybe I'll have an opportunity to look into it a little bit, maybe I won't, but just because somebody with a PhD says this is the way it was does not necessarily mean that that's the way it was. Because I can guarantee you, you can find another person with a PhD who'll say that's not the way it was. Now, whose PhD is better? I mean, you ultimately are going to have to stop and think about how did they come to this conclusion? Why are they saying that it's the case? And that's where you start to get, that's the arena where people who are spend more of their time as serious students of the Bible really have to get in there and think about the sources that they're using and that sort of thing. And that sort of decision is not for everyone to wrestle with necessarily, but it's helpful for all of us to recognize that this is how it works. That when somebody says, this is what the Greeks did, what they mean is, in my academic circles, this is what we have decided that the Greeks did. And maybe that's great. Maybe it's true. But there are academic circles, and then there are academic circles, and some of them don't agree with each other on these things. So it's just helpful to recognize that that's the case. But the main thing for anybody to recognize is it can be helpful to learn something about what was going on in the world back then, and there are other sources of information besides the Bible for those things. Now, my last piece of advice is similar to my first one, but I want to focus this on the issue of background assumptions. Force yourself to make sure that you or all others who are teaching you from the Bible have not just read your own background assumptions into the text. You have got to ask yourself that question. You've just got to ask yourself that question. You have to recognize that that can happen. We may think that we have no background assumptions. I hear people say that a lot. Oh, no, I just read it. I don't have any assumptions I bring to it. I just read it. But we do. We always have a picture of what we think is going on in a text. I mean, we can't be a blank slate. And typically, what we as Christians have been trained to do, unless we have evidence to the contrary, now, you may not buy this, but I'll tell you, this is what's going on in most of our heads. This is how we were trained to think about it. This is the background to whatever biblical text I'm reading. This book was written to 21st century Americans to give us specific pieces of advice on how to have a better life. That's the background to every text that I read in the Bible, unless I stop and think otherwise. I just assume it was written to people like me in my situation to tell me how to get what I want. That's the background that I bring to the text. And what I have to do is force myself to recognize, well, no, actually, this was written to the Corinthians who were having this problem where they were choosing up sides between themselves, or this was written to the Galatians who were wrestling with the question of whether you needed to become a Jew in order to be saved. I mean, it's putting myself in that spot and saying, this is the issue. These are the people to whom it was being written. This is what it was about. Then, of course, I want to take what's there and apply it to my life. It's going to be relevant to my life, but I have to start by understanding it in the historical situation in which it's written. Let me give you an example. This is a very popular verse in Christian circles. I'm sure you've heard it before. It comes up all the time. The verse reads as follows. If my people, who are called by my name, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, and will heal their land. Now, I don't know how many times I have heard that verse. Basically, Christians say, look at the United States. You know, we're going down the tubes. We've become a moral sewer, and we're going to be destroyed as a nation. And what this verse is telling us is if we will repent and turn to God and pray and repent of our sins, then we will not be destroyed as a nation and we will prosper once again. Or else, sometimes it's interpreted a little differently. Since it's talking about my people need to pray, this is a promise that if Christians would get together and pray to God, then God would forgive the United States for its moral problems and would raise us back up. I mean, one of those two approaches to the verse. Well, would it be appropriate for the people in the United States to repent? Absolutely. Would it be appropriate for Christians to pray to God for mercy for our country? Absolutely. Would it be out of the question to think that God might actually respond to those prayers by being merciful and raising up our country? No, he could do a thing like that. But what I'm saying is, when we read this verse, we can't just take it and apply it to the United States and say, see, this is a promise that if we will just pray, God will bless our land. Because that's not the background, that's not the historical context into which it's being spoken. This is in 2 Chronicles, and it comes right after Solomon has prayed a very long prayer at the dedication of the temple. David said he wanted to build a temple for God. But God said, no, you're not going to build a temple for me. Your son is going to build this house for me. And so Solomon now has built the temple, and he has this prayer where he's thanking God for what he's done and so on. But throughout this prayer, he keeps saying basically, look, God, this temple that I've just dedicated here, I'm asking you that when we sin, we, your people, Israel, when we sin and you punish us and you send us out to other countries into exile and all kinds of terrible things happening, I'm praying that if we repent, that you will remember your promises that you have made to us as a people and bring us back into the land and restore us. That's the sort of thing that Solomon has been praying over and over again. If a man sins, if we sin, if we get taken into captivity, I'm asking that if we turn to your temple, to where you dwell in a certain sense, and we call out to you there, will you bring us back here? Will you restore us? We have to understand this in the context that Solomon understands it, which are in the context of two very important promises. There is the promise that was made to Abraham, the Abrahamic covenant, that involves a promise that his descendants would live in that land and prosper. And then there's the promise that God made to David, the Davidic covenant, that David's throne would last forever. And so here's Solomon, in the light of the promises made to Abraham and in light of the promises made to David, praying to God, if we stray, if we mess up, if we sin, if we turn back to you and call out to you here at this temple that we have dedicated that you will bring us back. That's his prayer over and over again as he dedicates the temple. And so then, in 2 Chronicles 7, then the Lord appeared to Solomon at night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. If I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or if I command the locusts to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among my people, and my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayer offered in this place. For now I have chosen and consecrated this house that my name may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you walk before me as your father David walked, even to do according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish your royal throne as I covenanted with your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man to be ruler in Israel. But if you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commandments, then I will uproot you from my land which I have given you, and this house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. So this whole context is all about the promises made to Israel, unique promises that have been made to no other nation, that God would establish them in this land, and if they were faithful, he would keep them there. And he's saying to Solomon, if I, in my wrath, strike out at this people, I will, if they repent, heal them and restore them in the land. Now, yes, the God we're dealing with is a God of mercy, and so we should call out to him with the expectation that he will be merciful. But he has made no promise to the United States, for instance, that it will last forever. The throne that our president sits on, so to speak, has not been promised that it is an eternal throne that will last forever. He did not come to the Irish or the Brazilians and say, you know, I am going to be your God forever, and I have made promises that you as a people will have a certain place and do certain things. It is only the Jews that he made those promises to. And this language about my people who are called by my name, this is language that is being addressed to the Jews and their unique situation. So there's just an example of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. We take a verse like that and we pull it out and say, that sounds great. What we need is healing of our land. And we'll take and run with that verse. And yes, the God we're calling out to is the one to call out to. There's no question about that. But this is not a promise like that. It's a very unique promise, very significant in the history of salvation theology, very significant that God makes this promise to Israel, but it's not the same as what he's promised me as a Gentile. So, just an example of where we're so ready to jump in and say, yes, that's mine, and grab it. Well, that's what I guess I'm urging all of us. Is that if we want to know what God has said, what God has revealed about himself, then we need to be willing to let him set the terms. And one of the ways that we can do that is to make sure that when people are speaking, or God is speaking in the Old Testament, or prophets are speaking, or apostles are speaking, that we recognize to whom are they talking and what are they talking about. That's what background information is ultimately all about. I may not be a scholar, I may not be a historian, but I can be a person who cares about what God said enough to be careful, to just try to pay attention. And that's really all that I'm urging. I think that's important for all of us here, is that to be the kind of people who want to know what the Bible is saying more than I want to impose my own message on it. That's important. And so for that reason, it's important for us to understand how the historical background can affect what we see there, even if we're not scholars. Okay, so I rambled on, and now it's your opportunity to ramble on a little bit. Questions, comments for little bit.
Could you cite a couple of examples from your own experience where two different authoritative scholars gave different opinions about something, and it made it it made a difference in how you looked at the passage and whether or not you came to a conclusion, or you know, just an illustration of that?
Sure, a couple, huh? All right. First, there are two models for the relationship between Paul and Peter in their sorting out the question of, do the Gentiles have to become Jews in order to be saved? In one model, Paul and Peter meet in Jerusalem at the time of the Jerusalem Council. The issue is kind of settled by the Jerusalem Council that the Gentiles do not have to become Jews. But later on, Peter goes to Antioch, where Paul is, and he stops eating with the Gentiles because he becomes afraid because some people from Jerusalem have come, and Paul chews him out, and it's kind of a decisive break between Paul and Peter, and these two parts of the church go their separate ways. The other model reverses it. Paul and Peter get together in Antioch. They have their little blowout on whether Peter should have eaten with the Gentiles or not. Paul saying, you should have. And then later on, finally, they get together in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Council happens, and the issue is settled, and now everybody's on the same page and it's been resolved. Whether you see Peter being chewed out by Paul before the Jerusalem Council or after the Jerusalem Council kind of determines the entire picture that scholars paint of the relationship between Paul and Peter. And you can find people who argue very vociferously on both sides, would put one here or the other here, and paint a very different picture. The one picture, the one that I think is right, is that the Jerusalem Council came second and settled the issue. That Peter and Paul came to a clear meeting of the minds together with the other apostles, and that they were solidly in agreement on that. But they had a kind of a rocky road in getting to that spot. But there are historical issues of how you date, where does the book of Galatians come, and how did Paul's missionary journeys happen, and when did they happen, and so on. Those historical issues are how you sort out those two questions. So you might read one book and they'll give you one of those pictures, and you might not be aware that actually there's somebody else over here who's arguing for a very different picture, and you have to make that assessment. One other quick example might be in more liberal scholarly circles that don't have a high view of the authority of the Bible, it has been argued that Christianity is essentially a Gnostic heresy, that Gnosticism sort of came on the scene first and Christianity arose out of it. Whereas there are other scholars who have argued, no, that's a misreading of the historical data, it's the other way around. Gnosticism is a Christian heresy, and Christianity came first, and Gnosticism arose out of that. And so there again is a place where, depending on who you read, especially that view of Christianity coming out of Gnosticism was more early 20th century Bultmann and those sort of folks, but if you read people influenced by them, they would tell you Christianity was just this thing that arose out of Gnosticism. And if you didn't know any better, you might think, well, I guess we know that that's the case. But in fact, we don't know that that's the case. It all depends on how you read the historical evidence. So there's a couple of examples, I guess.
Hey, Ron, I don't know if you're into doing this, but would you be willing to maybe name some names of authors of what you would call decent books that we could find historical background on the New Testament? And specifically, are there any that deal with, that are exhaustive volumes of all the books? And no. And if you're not into doing that, that's okay. I mean, I won't take them as ultimate truth.
Yeah.
I promise.
Yeah. Well, the problem is you have to realize who you're dealing with here. I'm actually very hard to please when it comes to this sort of thing. So it's hard for me to say, oh, this is great, you've got to use this book, because I have problems with most of the books that I read, which sounds terrible. I mean, why would you want to even listen to me? This guy can't, he doesn't think anybody's any good. But you just have to be really careful.
I
find more helpful sometimes for background on particular books, if you can find a good commentary. And there are not a lot of good commentaries, but there are some. But a good commentary written by somebody who recognizes what kind of questions you need to ask and how you might go about answering those questions, they can sometimes point you in the direction of some good historical information. Otherwise, I mean, for a first shot, you know, as I'm just trying to learn some basic stuff, things like Bible encyclopedias and stuff like that are great. I mean, you can pick up a lot of information in those. Not all of it is accurate, but I mean, you can get in the ballgame by looking up, you know, what some of the Bible encyclopedias have to say. But historical reconstructions have a lot to do with the biases of the person who puts them together.
Sure.
So, you know, I could say, well, there's a book that's on, it's, I forget what it's called, but it's like the background commentary of the New Testament or something like that. I have that book. I thought, well, that sounds good. My experience with that book is that it's been, to me, almost useless. It doesn't do what I think needs to be done, and it has a lot of tendentious sort of speculative stuff that doesn't seem to me to be very reliable.
There's no names for me?
Well, let me think.
And maybe, you know what, actually I can pass the mic off and
okay.
Maybe we
if
can
any,
talk
if
about
any
that
names come to mind, I'm okay. Sure there are things, but nothing is immediately coming to mind. More certain people who have written commentaries that I think are good at what they do that I would recommend. But I don't know what you would do with the kind of advice I just gave you. Yeah, look, you know, there are references out there. Of course, none of them are any good. It's just not that simple, one way or the other.
Did you ever buy anyone a gift of a book?
Something like a set of Bible encyclopedias or something like that I think are useful.
Why?
Well, but see, I don't know. Part of it is I'm old. I mean, I used to, the set that I have, that I've used for the past 25 years is a Zondervan Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible, which has some nice information on it, and it's coming from a reasonably conservative perspective. By that, what I mean is that most of the people who wrote the articles actually believe in God, you know, and stuff like that. So that's useful, but it's 25 years old at least, and it has its own biases. It's just, as I have dabbled in some of the newer things, there seem to be trends that are emerging and what people find compelling that you can just attribute it to my age if you want, but I don't find it compelling. I think you go back to that 25-year-old Bible encyclopedia and I think it's going to be more reliable than a lot of stuff that I'm seeing out there now. But there, like I say, it just depends. If you were studying the book of Matthew, I would say get D.A. Carson's commentary on Matthew. He's great. What's that? Yeah. I mean, Carson, D.A. Carson is one of my favorite academics. I mean, out there, Christian scholars out there. He has a good perspective on the Bible. He knows how interpretation not to happen. He's a smart guy. He knows a lot. He has some really valuable things to say. But he hasn't written in answer to your question, he hasn't written a book like, here's everything you need to know about the whole Bible or something like that, so I couldn't recommend. But I could say, anything of D.A. Carson's you ever find is worth reading, I think. Even I may disagree with him sometimes, but even when I disagree with him, it was valuable, what he had to say.
What do you think of Donald Guthrie's Introduction to the New Testament?
It's pretty good. His introduction is pretty good.
Guthrie goes into some of the critical scholar issues too, so if you're not really familiar with that kind of stuff, it'll introduce you.
Again, that's an older book. Which tends to be, when it comes to reference books, most of the books that I know are older books, because, that was when I was really, around 25 years ago when I was really, that's when I was buying up every book I could get my hands on and looking at all this stuff. And then after a while, you just kind of settle down and say, well, I think I'll just work with what I've got. So, Guthrie is good. His introduction is good. Yeah, I forgot one. There is one book I like a lot for F.F. Bruce wrote a book called New Testament History, I think it is. No, not that one. That's a good book too. But this is a history book, and especially it deals with the intertestamental period coming up to the New Testament. It gives you perspective on those questions like who were the Pharisees and what were their beliefs and Jesus is talking to scribes, who are scribes, and lawyers, who are lawyers, and all of that stuff. That's a very helpful book in getting perspective on the Gospels in particular, I think. So that I like that book. That's a good one.
Have you ever used Edersheim?
Edersheim is quite old and has a reputation for being not entirely reliable. That's Edersheim, that's Old Testament. Yeah, right. And he has an Old Testament one as well, I think. Yeah, I mean, it couldn't hurt. I mean, it give you sort of a picture of that world, but I don't... He's kind of the old school that didn't mind getting a little fanciful. How they did stuff, and later folks came along and subjected his claims to critique and thought some of it didn't hold up, probably wasn't so. But a book like called Light, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, maybe that would be like, seeing a movie, set in ancient times or something. It may have some inaccuracies in it, but it'll kind of give you a feel anyway of what's going on. So it's not like it's terrible or anything. I still, half the stuff I know about the Roman emperors and the time of the New Testament and all that stuff, I learned from I, Claudius. That BBC series with Derek Jacobi. Whenever I have a question, did this guy come before this guy? I just think back. Oh yeah, that actor played that guy. That actor played that guy and he came after him. So there are a lot of different ways to pick up information. So. Thanks.